from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Jim Fruchterman is a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur, but he's known his share of failure. In fact, he's big on failure and what you can learn from it. His first startup was, in fact, a spectacular failure, a rocket-building venture that blew up on the launching pad. But you don't get to become a MacArthur Genius Grant winner without a few successes, including his latest venture, a nonprofit called Benetech that specializes in developing technological tools to help human rights investigations, environmental campaigns, and the disabled. A conversation with Jim Fruchterman, part of our first-person series featuring those who make a difference in the Bay Area. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Jim Fruchterman has had an unusual career in high tech. He dropped out of Stanford Graduate School, and five of the first seven companies he started failed. In fact, his commencement address at St. Mary's College this year featured this advice: fail early, fail fast, and fail often. But Jim Fruchterman has also had lots of success, of course. His idea to use optical technology to scan and edit textbooks scored big, an idea that led to building inexpensive reading machines for the blind. And it was with that device that Fruchterman found his calling. He created a nonprofit venture called Benetech. Its mission is to use technology to do good. Benetech specializes in creating technological tools to aid everything from human rights investigations to assisting the disabled. Their efforts aimed at dealing with what he calls market failures, areas of need the market and the tech industry fail to address. Jim Fruchterman is a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and he joins us this morning as part of our continuing first-person series, where we feature the distinctive individuals, innovators, and leaders who are making a difference in the Bay Area. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you here. I'm interested in this concept first of market failure, that technology normally, of course, is focused on where can we find a market? Where can we find somebody who will take this new app of ours and build it into something that's profitable? You're zeroing in on exactly the opposite in a way. You're looking at where the market fails.
Well, I think in Silicon Valley, we're trained to make a lot of money. I mean, we have a machine for popping out new companies that are highly profitable. And you are trained that if it's not going to pencil out, if it's not going to make money, drop it. And that's frustrating because there's so many great things that technology could do to help humanity, help society. And so I think what we're trying to focus on is, where does the technology already exist? We have a commercial reason for it to exist. Where could we take it and apply it to these big social needs and maybe serve not just the richest 10% of the planet, but maybe the other 90%?
Well, let's take an example, which in some ways struck me as the most unlikely, but perhaps not, which is if you think about sort of new ventures and the ways technology could be used, probably the first thing to come to mind would not be human rights abuses.
Right.
So tell us something about how you are using technology to provide a service to those who are engaged in dealing with human rights investigations.
So think of human rights as an industry that does nothing but process information. The only asset a human rights group have is the sort of legitimate stories of suffering, of human rights abuses that someone in their community has experienced.
So it starts with collecting data.
Yeah, and that's a data issue. Well, boy, we know about that here. And so, but no one writes software for human rights groups because, all right, the worldwide market for human rights software is probably $1 or $2 million a year. That's, you know, a total non-starter. But if you use information, as we do, first to collect the legitimate stories of human rights abuse. So we're working with LGBT groups in four African countries to help build a record of the abuses that community is serving, is basically experiencing as a result of discrimination and abuse. We're helping war crimes tribunals decide, was it genocide? That's a data question. You know, we actually have statisticians at Benetech who help figure out, hey, if you're a Mayan Indian in Guatemala during the 80s, 5 or 8 times the chances of dying if you're a Ladino, which is the white-related ethnic group there. So looks like genocide. So we're actually testifying in a case against the former dictator of Guatemala, Rios Montt, on that point. So data falls all the way through. We say it's the balance between sort of anecdote, the story of an individual suffering so that people care, and analysis that say 5, 10,000, 100,000 people experience that same abuse, and we have to do something not only against the people who perpetrated it by actually killing someone, but the people behind them that put the policy in train that caused 10,000 or 100,000 people to die.
So is the problem that typically in human rights cases and human rights, alleged human rights abuses around the world, that you get anecdotal information, a story here, a story there, and that in a way is also therefore sometimes easy to discount because it's a story here and a story there, and you don't really know exactly what's what. So how do you turn that anecdote into something that feels like that's concrete data and evidence that can be used on to bring about an investigation?
The number one attack by people who are apologizing for dictators and human rights abusers is that, well, those people are lying. You know, that victim, you know, her husband wasn't a labor organizer. He was a common criminal. You know, those 14 guys who all got shot in the back of the head, well, they were actually armed guerrillas and they all got caught in a crossfire, but they all happened to be facing the wrong way. I mean, you actually add this data together and say, did these people all sort of collaborate to basically construct this elaborate lie? Or is the data actually pointing to culpability and a pattern of abuse that indicates policy? And so, you know, one of the common questions we get is, well, all those people are lying. And we're like, well, look, we gathered information from refugee camps in this country and that country, and then we did a household survey, random sampled, and the story seems to be consistent. Do we think they all got together in a giant meeting that we didn't know about and all agreed that they were going to lie the same way? I mean, statistics, independent data collection help show the underlying patterns in a way that is strong and defensible in whether it's a court, an international criminal court, or whether it's in the courts of public opinion.
Jim Fruchterman joins us. He is the founder and CEO of Benetech, a nonprofit venture in the Silicon Valley that works to bring technology to causes that aren't necessarily served by the usual marketplace. Did people think you were nuts when you started doing this? Like, I mean, this is not the standard Valley MO.
Yeah, when we started this 23 years ago, I remember having one conversation with a guy saying, so you're going to build this up and you're going to take it public and then you're going to make a lot of money. And like, we're already public, and if I took the money, I'd go to jail. That's the nature of a charity, of a nonprofit. But, you know, the Valley was really solely focused on greed, let's say in the late 90s, and people thought I was out of my mind. I think now people are starting to try to find more relevance in the work that they're doing. People are more aware of, you know, globalization and human rights abuses because technology has made it easier to be more aware of that. The media has brought more of these things into our living room. We know a lot more about what's going on in Syria today than we would have 20 years ago if this was happening. And so there's a lot of energy actually from the Silicon Valley community to connect with this work. And a lot of what we're trying to do is channel that energy into things that will make a difference.
So that brings me to sort of one of your latest projects, which is called Social Coding for Good. And it sounds a bit like, you know, a kind of like Match.com, a sort of you're trying to match up sort of techies, a dating service for techies, only the date is to do good, right?
That's right. And in fact, we actually want to tell people, you know, what's your passion? What's your skill? What's your time availability? And oh, gosh, Wikimedia needs you to help with the Wikipedia, or Code for America needs you to help with software for communities, or maybe Khan Academy needs you to work on their educational videos. And so we're trying to bridge that gap between the desire and the actual groups that know something about it. And, you know, there are 50 or 100 groups like Benetech that are making software for social good as our primary product. And boy, we could use a lot of help from the expertise and the time and, of course, you know, the donors, the money from Silicon Valley.
And are people – where is the kind of barometer on that within the Valley now? It's often, as you mentioned earlier, the view is that Silicon Valley is not the most philanthropic place in the world. It's all about the sort of next new thing and the next new profit. Do you feel that's changing? What do you think Silicon Valley needs to do that it's not doing that?
I think we've gone through a couple big shifts. One is this crop of, let's say, college students is the most socially activated group I've seen since the 60s. So they're on fire about social good. And when you try to recruit them to work for your high-tech company, they are interested in, well, are you guys doing evil stuff? I mean, these kind of questions are actually being asked. So high-tech companies are saying, we want to give our employees volunteerism opportunities to hone their skills and help the community. So we're actually seeing this demand from a very business-like, you know, recruiting and retention of employees. And then we've got people on the other end. I mean, you know, Silicon Valley creates an awful lot of wealthy people who are wealthy much younger in their lifespan than normal. And a lot of them, you know, keep on starting companies. But a lot of them step back and say, is this really what's feeding my inner soul? And so they're going back to teaching, or they're organizing hackathons, or they're getting involved in a given country that they're passionate about or an issue they're getting passionate about. And so I think from both ends, we're seeing this increased demand for more social relevance. Now, we can't change the way business actually works overall in terms of being market-focused, but we can kind of infect this social meme in what they do. So they're always thinking, how could we use our technology, our intellectual property for social good? And you already see this in every area you can imagine. There's a couple of nonprofit pharma companies here in San Francisco that are starting to make drugs for diseases that no for-profit pharma company would ever do. But yet the pharmaceutical scientists behind it are like, we came into this field because we want to save lives. And okay, maybe making middle-aged men feel like teenage boys again is where the market is. But boy, I would rather make a drug that, you know, kills a parasite that kills 100,000 people a year. Maybe I can do a little bit of both.
Jim Fruchterman, again, the founder and CEO of Benetech. He joins us as part of our first-person interview series. I want to come back to the hackathon that you mentioned a moment ago because it's an intriguing concept. But I want to also ask you about how you got here. You grew up not, as I understand it, wanting to save the world. You wanted to be a rocket scientist and a builder of rockets. How did this happen? What changed?
I think the linkage is sort of the geek linkage, right? The love of technology, the love of science, love of figuring things out. When I was a kid growing up in the Midwest, becoming an engineer or a scientist was not what your parents wanted you to do. They wanted to become a doctor or a lawyer because that's where the money was. This was sort of pre-entrepreneurship, right? So I came to California, I came to Caltech, and I wanted to become a scientist astronaut or win a Nobel Prize in physics, something like that. And, you know, I kept sort of learning about all this cool technology. And I was actually in a class where we were learning how to make optical pattern recognition systems to guide smart bombs. It would actually recognize a tank and go and blow it up. And I had to do a project for that class. And I went, I wonder if there's a more socially beneficial application of this technology. And then even though I didn't know a single blind person or anything, I just said, wow, maybe you could recognize words and read to a blind person. That was like my one good idea in college. And, you know, coming to Silicon Valley, you know, through, you know, a bunch of twists and turns, I ended up actually being able to do that.
So describe what that wound up being, the quite inexpensive, right, reading machine that was based on that, on smart bomb technology.
Yeah. And you know, and it had commercial applications, right? So we actually raised $25 million in venture capital in the 80s to build a machine that could read anything, not to help the blind, but to help the IRS scan tax forms and to route the mail and help lawyers scanning contracts. But in the very founding of that company, we listed helping blind people as one of the three or four things we could do with the technology. And then the day came that our teams built a reading machine for the blind prototype. I was the VP of marketing. My best friend was the VP of engineering. Our teams built it. We showed it to our investors. We demonstrated it. It read the book aloud, you know, in a very mechanical voice. And they said, well, what's the market size? And I said, I think it's about $1 million per year. They were unimpressed with this opportunity financially. And so So that's actually how Benetech got started. Is I eventually quit and said, I promise not to compete with you guys, but why don't you give me the right to do this reading machine for the blind that you don't think is interesting? And the fact that I was outside the company instead of distracting inside the company, they were perfectly okay with it. Actually, the amazing thing I think people don't realize is that when I go to a high-tech company or an intellectual property company like a publisher and I ask for their stuff, not money, stuff, they say yes 80 or 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. People really want to see their stuff used for social good.
And tell us something about the evolution of that idea, because mm-hmm. that's gone on now to a concept called Bookshare that's part of Benetech. What does it provide?
So during the 90s, we made reading machines so blind people could scan for themselves. In late 99, the founder, the then acting CEO of Napster lived two doors down, and her son gave my son Napster. And I went, ooh, this is cool. So maybe these 40,000 people who are scanning books for themselves could actually scan the book once.
Napster is the music sharing
exactly.
phenomenon.
Exactly. Sort of peer-to-peer, the power of the internet of people to kind of do stuff. And we said, wow, what if all our users, every time they scanned a book, they just shared it. And then no one else would have to scan a book. Like when Harry Potter would come out, you know, 2,000 families would each spend 3 hours scanning Harry Potter and get a lousy, low-quality version of Harry Potter that hadn't been proofread by, you know. But if you had one person do it and one person proofread the character recognition and make it perfect, now all those thousands of families and a bunch of other kids who would never get around to scanning it could actually have it. So that's the idea of Bookshare. Amazon meets Napster, meets talking books for the blind, but legal. So Amazon, it's all online. Napster, for the first 5 years, it was all peer-produced. Basically, any book you thought was worth scanning, we thought was worth having. And quickly, we had the largest library for the blind. Talking books. We used electronic book technology. 10 years ago, that was kind of what my friends in Silicon Valley told me was going to happen. And so we can turn it into Braille, large print, synthetic voice, and it's legal. There's actually a copyright law exception that makes it legal for us to scan just about any book.
Jim Fruchterman joining us. His nonprofit venture, Benetech, provides technological tools to help everything from human rights investigations to assisting the blind to environmental efforts, which we haven't talked about yet, to promoting literacy. We're going to open up our phone lines in just a moment, and we'd like to hear from you in part about what would you like to see Jim Fruchterman tackle next? What sort of causes are out there that the market really isn't meeting, that technology could help? And we'd like to hear your ideas about the way in which technology could provide a social good, and also what your thoughts are about the philanthropic standard in Silicon Valley, whether or not there's more that could be done to Silicon Valley. Here's the number if you would like to join our conversation and make your suggestions at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Before we start taking our calls, I want to ask you something about failure. I mentioned in the open that five out of your first seven companies failed and that you're kind of big on failure. Mm-hmm. Your advice at St. Mary's College commencement address that you just gave was fail early, fail fast, fail often. How come?
You know, in Silicon Valley, we celebrate failure. It's how we actually make companies more successful. The new standard in web development is to build a prototype, or in hardware development, build a prototype quick. And if it goes nowhere, start over. Don't invest 2 years in building something perfect and then finding out no one actually wants it. And so we feel that if you're going to take risk, and the nonprofit world is kind of risk averse. If you're going to take risk, you want to boldly go somewhere that no one has gone before. Sometimes you will fall flat on your face. And in our case, we at Benetech actually had one spectacular failure. We wanted to make a humanitarian landmine detector.
Huh.
Basically using the kind of technology that you would use the shoe bombing scanning was the commercial application. And the engineers involved loved it. We could never get export permission from the right set of agencies at the same time. And our donor, who is also a tech kind of driven people, said, hey, you guys want to write that up? Go right ahead. Celebrate that failure. Let people know what you learned and why you failed, and tell me what you learned from that.
What did you learn?
We were politically unsophisticated, and that's not uncommon here in Silicon Valley. So now I spend a lot more time in Washington being a lot more aware of sort of what's going on politically, not because I really think of ourselves as activists in the traditional sense of trying to change policy. But if we're not tuned in, you know, we naively thought that everyone would think that helping save people from landmines would, you know, who would be against that? But, one person finally whispered in my ear, they said, if we license this technology to you and it could possibly help terrorists, you know, who in the government wants to be responsible for having given a nonprofit military technology that could help terrorists? Even if it was implausible, this is the possibility they could say that. It's scary as heck in Washington.
Is the value of failure then something that nonprofits, as you look at the nonprofit world, they need to learn and to be less afraid? Do you look at nonprofits generally, philanthropic organizations, charities generally, as being too risk adverse, too careful, too cautious?
I do, and I think that they're not doing that for unsophisticated reasons. If all your donors discourage failure and stop funding you if you ever fail, you will never acknowledge failure. In other words, I think people are doing this because they want to do social good and they're listening to their donors that are an important part of this. So a lot of what I'm trying to do is influence the donors to say, look, if you really want to make big social change, if you want sort of an order of magnitude 10x kind of change, you know, expect half the things you try to fail, and don't punish people for having failed boldly, much as venture capitalists don't, you know, punish people who have failed boldly. Of course, don't fail three times in a row.
Well, speaking of three times, your other advice to St. Mary's graduates was to sort of adopt the golden rule on steroids and do three times as much in the way of that as otherwise.
We call it karma banking. Basically, the idea that you keep making deposits in the karma bank, not expecting ever to get repaid. And it's the way Silicon Valley works. You don't get your venture-backed company started because you threw, you know, business plans over the transom. You worked a network of people. It's actually – I learned this from Silicon Valley business. And then I figured out that in the nonprofit world, it's just as good. So we do lots of favors. And then occasionally something we didn't expect nice happens to us. And we can maybe never connect it to having done a specific favor. But I am certain the fact that we're out there making a lot of favors and just doing it for the good of doing it, it makes us feel better, and I think it helps society be better.
Describe a hackathon.
So a hackathon is actually sort of this positive grouping of a weekend of people who all want to get together and solve a problem, and they want to do it fast. The origin of hack is a quick and dirty solution to a problem. It doesn't have this sort of negative cracking, you know, breaking into websites sort of connotation. So, for example, last weekend we were with Random Hacks of Kindness, which is one of the coolest groups that we work with, and they worked on porting our human rights software to the Android phone and working on software to help blind students learn math. And this weekend, I'm attending another hackathon at Frog Design, which is one of Silicon Valley's top design firms, that's around sort of, they call it the reinvent business hackathon. They want to make business sort of a more human and truly social enterprise. And they're trying to change regular business, not going outside of it like I did.
Let's take a call, and then we'll go after our break. But let's get in one caller before our break. Paul in San Francisco is our first caller. Paul, go ahead.
Hi, Jim. It's Paul Herman. Great to see your continued leadership here. So you just alluded to sort of business and for-profit. Can you talk about what for-profit investors might be doing this, who have either taken their tech money and are investing in things that have a positive social good and a potential financial return?
It's great to hear from you, Paul, as one of the leaders in impact investing. Impact investing is a new category, which is where you're trying to make money, but you're also trying to do social good.
So to be clear, Benetech is a nonprofit. What Paul is talking about is making money doing good.
That's right. And you know, because we're tackling sort of spectacular market failure, sometimes you could imagine us making money, but usually you can't. But there's a lot of areas in this sort of gray area where it's not returning 10x your money, which is sort of the Silicon Valley goal. But for example, low-income housing, green energy, microcredit. When we had our big financial crisis, the people who had invested their money in these socially relevant things made far more money over that time period than the people who lost their shirts in the equity market. So it's not only social impact, but also good business. And it's one of the hottest areas in our area in sort of this field of social good is how can we turn this into a social enterprise? You know, we're graying the lines between make money at all costs, damn society sort of outcomes, you know, I don't care if I'm polluting the planet, all the way over to pure charity. There's a whole bunch of people in this middle zone, whether it's nonprofits like Benetech that are 80% funded by revenue or for-profits, you know, like The Body Shop or other sorts of groups that are trying to actually make money doing social good.
If someone is interested in investing for social good, one of your colleagues in Silicon Valley, one of those wealthy 28-year-old millionaires who's already made it from creation of some smart app, where do you find out? Where do you go?
Oh, Silicon Valley is full of this. The Bay Area is full of this kind of stuff. We run the largest conference in the world on this topic. It's called the Social Capital Markets Conference. It's held here in San Francisco every fall. We have the hub in the Chronicle building on Mission at Fifth, which is 100 people. They're all inventing new businesses around social good, and they're investors, they're social media people. There's so much going on. You just search impact investing, social entrepreneurship, social enterprise, and you're going to get turned on to an incredible wealth of opportunities to get involved.
Paul, thanks for the call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls. Where would you like to see technology go in creating more social good? What needs are out there that the market is not addressing? What can Silicon Valley do to become more philanthropic? We'll take your calls when we come back. Again, here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. You can post your questions, ideas on our Facebook page as well as our website. More with Jim Fruchterman and Benetech when we come back. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour is part of our continuing first-person series where we talk to people who are making a difference in the Bay Area in some distinctive way. Jim Fruchterman, he's the founder and CEO of Benetech, which seeks to figure out ways technology can be used to advance various social goods. We welcome your questions and thoughts. What would you like to see technology tackle that it has not tackled yet? 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Nerv. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in San Francisco.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Nerv, and I'm a human rights activist and a country specialist for Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. And I'm leading a development of a mobile phone application that tracks down possible exit routes during cases of state-perpetrated abduction and disappearances. And I've been following the work of Benetech and Jim particularly. And I'm interested because my main concern with this project is how do I relate the development of this technology to the prosecution and investigation of human rights cases. And I'm wondering what Jim has to say about that.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a burgeoning field of technology helping the human rights movement, right? So we have Tor, which is to get basically around firewalls that keeps, you know, basically people from accessing the media outside their country. There are people trying to make secure cell phones for human rights groups. We just got some money from Radio Free Asia to help journalists collecting data in Southeast Asia under, you know, pressure. So there's a group of people, and actually more and more they're meeting. The State Department, the U.S. State Department, is putting a lot more money in this area. And so what we have is we have the tech developers who are coming up with cool things, and then we have actually groups on the ground. And they're actually our customers. We actually have to solve their problem. And so I think NERV's idea of a app that could actually help people figure out a way to get out of a country, let's say if they're about to be shelled or cordoned off or whatever it might be, is a good one. And there's a network of basically human rights tech trainers around the planet. And so, you know, they should get in touch with us, and we'll connect them in with sort of that network.
And is this another example, though? We mentioned that you also have to be savvy politically and all of these issues. We saw that during the Arab Spring, of course, and the various technological obstacles and how you deal with all of that. But this is, you need everybody engaged in order to make these things happen.
Yeah. And you know, we're the techies, right? I mean, it's the human rights activists on the ground that are taking risks with their lives. They're quite sophisticated about what they're doing. They're taking big risks. Our job is first to do no harm. And sometimes techies create things they think will help that actually do some harm. So you have to be a little bit more plugged in there. And then you actually have to listen to these users. They're not very technical in many cases. So you actually have to be sure that your technology actually works to solve their problem rather than sort of your fantasy about what their problem is.
NERV, thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Cindy in Stinson Beach this morning. Cindy, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. I have a sister who is hard of hearing, and like a lot of people with hearing trouble, what is most difficult for her is hearing conversation in a group. Mm-hmm. And a few of us were talking one day about how, you know, most of what you need is already there, voice recognition software and everything. And I would love to see someone create something where with instant voice recognition in a group named, and so the hard of hearing person can see the text on the screen, maybe have it color-coded, maybe have each person wear a monitor around their neck or something. Mm-hmm. You know, with an aging population, it's going to continue to get worse, and I think a lot of hearing, hard of hearing people have that problem with background noise and a lot of people talking at once.
Cindy,
so
thanks.
Can somebody do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an area that we've actually brainstormed with a lot of people about because of this challenge. And one of our problems is voice recognition isn't that good yet. And in a crowded room, it has problems, just like a hard of hearing person has problems. So I think Cindy's idea of maybe having someone wear a mic, which will help you isolate it, and then maybe have the person actually having their hearing aid, maybe listening to the person who's currently speaking and pulling it out. But, you know, we even dream of more fancy things. I mean, I would love to have my glasses actually display the text of the words that someone is saying to me, right? We have heads-up displays for fighter pilots, and why not for hard-of-hearing people?
So is this a good example of how you proceed? Someone like Cindy comes up with an idea. You think about it. You go to it, and it bounces around, and then it winds up being text on someone's glasses.
Yeah. We actually have a process. Every week, someone comes to us and says, the market is failing to use technology for this socially cool thing. You should do it. And so we actually have a process for putting through all those ideas. And what we do is we take the kind of venture capitalist approach, but every one of the 10 things a VC would do, we do a social twist. It's not return on investment, it's return to humanity. You know, we want low technical risk, we want it to be sustainable, it doesn't have to be profitable, and we want to have great partners and great people who understand the problem. And every year we pick one or two new ventures to actually launch that way.
So what are you going to do with Cindy's idea?
We actually will put it in the hopper, and at the end of the year, we're going to sit there and say, all right, what are the top 5 or 10? And then we'll put some students to work on those, and then, you know, a year later, one will pop out. It takes a little longer that way, but, you know, the market's not going to do it anyway.
Cindy, thanks. Thanks for getting us started with that idea, and we'd love to hear more. If you have a suggestion or a concern or an area of need that you think Benetech or technology in general, Silicon Valley in general, for that matter, ought to attack, you can join us at 866-733-6786. Ann in Pacifica is next. Ann?
Hi. I'm a medieval historian, so I would say that right now Google Books and Gutenberg are concentrating on the wrong books, which are the most recent and the most famous. And actually, it's more important to put on the web the oldest books and manuscripts. Because these are the least accessible to people. They're never open shelf type things. You have to go to some special library far away, which is expensive, and you can only take them out with monitoring. And they're also very fragile, some of them, and so they're likely to fall apart before.
Great idea. Thank you, Anne. Jim Fruchterman.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, this is a dream of a lot of sort of Silicon Valley people who like old books. And so we have more and more people putting scans of these books online for free. I know David W. Packard, his Packard Humanities Institute did this with a lot of Greek and Latin books and made them widely available. So I think that there's a lot of excitement about that, even though, to be honest, most of my blind and dyslexic users are demanding books published in the last 10 years.
And thanks for the call and the suggestion. Speaking of which, why don't you demonstrate one of those ideas that you've come up with. This is called Read to Go. Describe what it is, Jim, and then you can play a little bit of it.
Yeah, Read to Go is a software app for the iPad and the iPhone, and it's basically designed for someone who's got blindness or dyslexia or low vision to actually read a book aloud. So it actually puts the book on the screen. It has sort of karaoke style, follow the bouncing ball, that turns out to be really important for dyslexic people to see and hear the word at the same time, and has a nice voice synthesizer that actually plays it aloud.
Harry sees the wand lying beside his camp bed, pointed it at the cluttered desk where he had left his glasses, and said, Axio glasses.
So that's just an example of modern text-to-speech, a Harry Potter book, and basically from the iPad, any of our users and any student in the United States who has one of these disabilities gets our services for free thanks to money from the Federal Department of Ed. They can actually download that book and be reading it in 30 seconds.
So is this kind of an update on the old books on tape or the recordings for the blind? This is just making it, turning that into a smartphone app?
Yeah, and that was kind of our tech breakthrough, is that when we started, recording the books aloud or turning them into hard copy Braille was the main way of doing it. We said, our friends in Silicon Valley said, you should do ebooks, and we can basically turn it into Braille on a Braille display or print it out on a Braille. We can make it large for someone with low vision, or we can do this sort of speaking it aloud. We can turn it into MP3 files for a kid who can't even afford a PC.
Sharon in Palo Alto. Sorry, Sharon, we'll get to you, I promise, but we jump to Raul in Palo Alto. Raul, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a student at UC Berkeley. I'm currently enrolled in the EECS program, and one of the things I've been noticing is that a lot of people care more about making like a quick app and a quick buck rather than working at organizations like Benentech. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what you guys are doing to get the students involved.
Well, one of the things I do is I go and I talk to a lot of students, and I explain how they can use their skills to actually do social good. And it's also social norming. For example, in the electrical engineering industry, basically the main association, their motto is to see that the technology actually benefit a lot of people. So they're totally into clean energy and solar energy and those sorts of things. But, you know, I don't have to change the mind of everybody who wants to get rich in Silicon Valley. I just have to influence them either, you know, later in the game, or when they're trying to figure out what to do with their money, or convince, you know, maybe the 5 or 10% that are predisposed to this message.
Raul, what do you think would what message would work to your fellow students? What would connect them?
So one thing for sure is, like, the hackathon is a great idea, and more hackathons towards, more hackathons like the ones that Jim was discussing would be really good within the university, because there are a lot of hackathons that go on, but they offer cash prizes and things like that. And all about, you know, getting a quick app out that lets you make some money, and usually it's generated around ad revenue and stuff like that.
Raul, thanks so much for pointing this. Here's a need, and so does that make you think that you ought to sponsor some of these hackathons at places like Raul's campus at UC Berkeley or at Stanford or wherever?
Oh yeah, I mean, students are looking for projects, and the great thing about being at the front lines of the social sector is that we're not that far from where students are in terms of their tech skills, because the companies aren't going there. So you may not be able to do, let's say, a router to compete with Cisco for your senior project, but you might come up with something incredibly cool around, say, clean energy in the developing world.
You know, it occurs to me that you were missing from a conversation I had earlier this week with Ken Auletta, who, as you may have read, wrote a very provocative piece about Stanford University in the New Yorker magazine recently that was called Get Rich You. And it was about how Silicon Valley and Stanford have this interconnected relationship and how that works to both benefit. But it also raised this question about whether or not, in Stanford's case at least, the Ken Auletta raised the point about whether or not it's sort of the university was kind of losing its way and that there was this kind of gold rush mentality at Stanford. Do you find that, as someone who was at Stanford for a while as a student, and that you need to, that Stanford could use a little injection of a place like Benetech?
You know, it's the same thing about the students are demanding it. So even at the business school, which is sort of a citadel of this sort of attitude, the most popular group on campus tends to be the social innovation or social entrepreneurship club. So the students want that. There's a group of faculty. They have tenure, so they can actually make these kind of choices. So, for example, there's a very famous professor, Balaji, at Stanford, who's a EE professor, really well known in the networking area. Cisco thinks he walks on water. He decided he wanted to get into social networking, and he wants to change the way people deal with commuting so that more people commute at off-peak times, saves energy, saves time. And so that's the direction he's heading. I spoke at a Stanford class last week. It was just on social innovation. So in all the departments at Stanford, I actually am seeing this demand for the social good overlaid with all the knowledge, and the people who are trying to get rich quick, well, they're about as big as I think the social innovation group is. They're just richer.
Sharon in Palo Alto is next and has an area she'd like to have Jim Fruchterman address. Sharon, go ahead.
Yes. My concern is in the environmental area regarding pollution. We could use a quick way to catch mobile polluters. For example, tank trucks that dump somewhere out in the countryside, or drug labs that come in and do something and then leave and leave the toxic waste. It's very labor-intensive and high cost for law enforcement to catch these individuals. So some system of focusing in on where they are so they can be caught more quickly to prevent more damage.
I think that's a great idea, Sharon. I think there's a bunch of sort of mobile apps designed to make it easier to do kind of whistleblowing, you know, or make people aware of these different issues. And, you know, the groups that actually have to accept them have to kind of, you know, sort the actual problems from the sometimes falsely reported ones. But it turns out that people don't actually falsely report very many of these things. And if you get there faster, you can catch people, which means because the police have to actually catch people in the act. It's very hard to like retrace how did this waste get into this, you know, into this meadow, right? So I think it's a great idea.
And describe some of your other efforts, because we haven't touched on this yet, within the environmental area, because you have some specific things that are aimed at helping various environmental organizations.
Yeah, we have one established project, and then there's a new environmental project that kind of won our, you know, what new project we should do this year. Maradi is a project management package for environmentalists, whether they're running a campaign or managing a wetlands restoration, a project, just basically the same kind of software you'd have if you were making a house or an apartment building, but oriented towards an environmentalist. It's been around for 3 or 4 years. It's open source and free, and our big users are groups like the Nature Conservancy and WWF.
So is this helping those sorts of environmental organizations be more business-like, have the proverbial business model in the way in which they're approaching things?
Exactly. Except for, you know, under the hood, it looks like the same kind of business model you'd have in any project management package, but it's all couched in environmental language. And actually, these environmental groups came to us and said, hey, we heard you wrote, you know, software for field people in the human rights movement. Can you write software for our field people, the biologist who's running this wetlands restoration project? And so it actually helps you figure out how to go from point A to board to B. And eventually, when you've actually answered all sort of the TurboTax-style questions, outspits your logic model, how a dollar in leads to more salmon or whatever your goal is.
Sharon, thanks. Thanks for the call. Couple of emails I want to read. Frederica writes in, I'm a documentary photographer. Mm-hmm. Do you see a way to integrate photography into the work that you're doing at Benetech?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we're partnering with a number of different groups that are working on this photography question. And we're actually leading some groups to kind of build a suite of technology to help documentary filmmakers, photographers, journalists, as well as human rights activists and social justice activists. So, for example, there's a project that we're not doing, but is part of sort of our network of groups that we work with that obscures the faces of people at demonstrations. So you can take a picture of a demonstration, but it'll automatically fuzz the faces so you won't be basically identified to the authorities as someone who was at a demonstration. And the software that we actually do use right now, our MARTA software, which is the main sort of grassroots software, you know, what it does is it takes text and pictures and audio and actually encrypts it and backs it up outside the country. So the information will never get lost. And that way you can recover it maybe when you're in a safer place.
Now, did I understand you that you were interested in having a photography application that people could use to sort of make – I'm not quite sure I'm understanding this – but to make people less identifiable at demonstrations? This strikes me as the kind of thing that the government would not be too enthusiastic about your developing.
Yeah, but this is a group that's already doing this today. There's a prototype of this actually working. And so the idea is that you go to a demonstration as a photographer or maybe even as just a casual activist, right? And you have an app that takes the picture and actually recognizes faces and then just fuzzes them out. And that's what gets sent out and maybe gets posted on social media. So you can say, yo, there really is a demonstration. Hey, look, here's someone on the ground. But you don't actually basically cause the people who are there or the witnesses more problems.
Debbie in San Jose is next. Debbie.
Hi, my name's Debbie. I'm a school nurse in San Jose, and I work with autism students. They can use communication devices. They're nonverbal for communication. The people that produce those type of products aren't interested in our group, and they're too fragile for common use. So I would like someone to take a product like an iPad and the existing software that packages out there and adapt it, make it accessible to our population.
Well, autism is a hot issue, and we have a project. I know of a project like what she's mentioning, what Debbie's mentioning. It's called ProLoquo to Go. It's an iPad app, and it's much cheaper than these kind of traditional, what they're called, augmentative communication devices. Someone like Stephen Hawking, the physicist who can't speak, uses one. And so people are putting these apps, and these big traditional devices cost thousands of dollars, and these apps cost, you know, $50, $100. Sometimes they're free. And so there's a lot of energy around that. And autism is such a big spectrum that some things work for some people and some don't. We have a project called Route 66 Literacy, and it's designed for people with autism and with developmental disabilities like Down syndrome who become teenagers but haven't learned to read. We figure about half of them could learn to read, but it's just going to take longer. And so the idea of Route 66 is to turn an ordinary literate person like me or you into someone who could actually teach reading, like an expert teacher of reading, to someone who's no longer going to be in first grade with a great primary school teacher.
Now, this would strike me as an area, as you say, there's so much interest in autism, and it seems to be a phenomenon that will be only greater in the future, where there is a market, where the market really ought to respond. Yeah?
Well, I think the key actually is the overlap between the specialty market and the mass market. And the iPad is a great example of this. The iPad is the coolest thing that's actually ever happened to autistic people. Not all of them, but it works better for most autistic people than every other computing device they've run into.
Why is that?
The interaction, the direct response. I mean, we're not talking about people who are keyboard users in many cases, right? So the fact that you can actually put your finger on something and have something happen, and it basically changes your approach to a computer as opposed to the somewhat disjointed mouse and keyboard mode that we have. And so, I mean, the iPhone, Apple chose to make accessible to blind people. So now iPhone is, you know, God's gift to blind people because it used to be Apple products were inaccessible, but now they're like totally accessible. And so I really salute the engineers at Apple for making the effort because it probably wasn't that big a commercial win. They decided to do it because they thought it was the right thing to do. And I applaud that.
Karma Bank, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Debbie, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Rose in Berkeley. Rose, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
And thank you for your good leadership and doing social good. I'm really enlightened to hear all about what you're working on. So my question is about the mass market that you just referred to, and that is the educational community. You know that California is behind, below Mississippi, and there is this widening digital divide in the K-12 classes. Folks are sending their kids to private schools or charter schools to escape the lack of resources for the typical public schools, and libraries, of course, have restricted hours. I'm just wondering if there is talk about how to either upgrade or even provide, connect the basic infrastructure to schools.
Well, I think that's a really great question, Rose, and you know, the tech community is all excited about the possibility of technology implementing, basically being implemented in education. And I think every time we have a major new wave of technology, it can go sort of one of two directions. It could either be the greatest thing since sliced bread for disadvantaged communities, or it could actually make the barriers higher. And so we're trying to keep putting in front of people how we can actually make it really terrific. So there's been a new wave of Common Core standards for K-12 education. We're going to have new textbooks the next couple of years. Right now we're trying to make sure that they're accessible from the get-go, and not only helping the blind and the 1 or 2% most disabled students, but maybe helping the 20 or 30% most disadvantaged. What if you were a kid whose parents didn't read or didn't read in English, and you had a cheap device that actually read to you? Now you'd start to catch up from the disadvantage you have from not having literacy at home.
Rose, thanks for the call. It's such an interesting juxtaposition when you think about it. When you think about all of the energy and wealth and brain power and technology, and in your case certainly, and in others, the desire to do good in Silicon Valley, and this difficult terrain in which the state of California finds itself. I mean, it'd be great if there was some technological fix for the fix that California needs. I mean, do you think about that, about ways to contend with the enormous problems facing the state?
Yeah, and it also points out the limitation of technology. Yeah. I mean, I can be sometimes accused of being a techno-utopian, but not every problem is ideally solved by technology. But when it comes to information and access into information and learning, I mean, let me just give you one example of something. We have something called big data. You know, Google and Facebook are collecting huge amounts of data about people, and they're figuring out how to make money off of it. Right now, we're going to have a new generation of kids that are going to be on devices where we're going to watch how they learn. And for the first time, we'll actually be able to see what really does work and doesn't work on an individual and then aggregate it. We actually may learn far more about how to teach kids in the next 10 years than we ever have before, because now we're able to collect data from millions of kids and watch the mistakes they make rather than just, did they pass the test? Passing a test, it's like the weakest way of learning how kids learn that I could imagine.
Don writes in, there are many green-oriented sites on the net, but many times their data sources are not transparent. Do you know about efforts to have data in common, like Wikipedia, so that you can leverage that data and ensure that the data remains transparent?
So actually, I had that conversation yesterday with Lucy Bernholtz of Stanford, who is imagining what's the sort of data commons that we actually can have. In other words, people all are sort of creating data. And right now, sort of by default, a few people are monetizing that, whether that's Amazon or Facebook. How do we actually contribute to a data commons and then be able to use that for science and for commerce, I mean, and for government decision making? One of our newest projects, we haven't written a line of code yet, so this is all sort of smoke and mirrors, but it's called City Options. The idea is communities want to do something about climate change. How do they know what to do? And they have all these websites and they're confused about how it happens. How can you come up with something open source and transparent, say, tell us your city, answer 20 questions about it, and then of the 1,000 things your city could do, here are the top 20. And here are 3 cities in your region that have done this in the last 3 years. And maybe because of the way cities, maybe they're all 100% successful online, but if you called up the project manager, maybe she'd tell you how it really worked and what she'd do differently if she were to do it again.
Let's get in one more call. John in Walnut Creek. John, go ahead, please.
Hi, this is thank you for taking my call. This is kind of a meta question. Sometimes I feel that as an IT person, consolidating existing data and making it available is a way to really get things done. One of my interests is tapping the vast pool of people who want to volunteer their time. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, would Venentech or would the MacArthur Awards, who would support something, because it's a scalability issue, of a way to for organizations, any organization that's looking for volunteers, to post their needs on the site so people living, say, throughout the United States or even the world could access that and find out what opportunities are available either to do things from their own computer or within a short transportation distance of where they actually reside.
That's a terrific thing, and there are people who have already done it. And so Volunteer Match here in San Francisco is the national group that does this best online. You say, I want something within 5 miles, it'll tell you. We have our volunteer listings on there. There's Sparked, which is like little micro-volunteering sort of things. We're going to have a major new project to have people do image descriptions for blind students, basically take a picture from a textbook and describe it. And of course, Social Coding for Good is about having people who have geek skills actually do this. So I think there's a tremendous number of opportunities in this area. And start with Volunteer Match and go from there. There's great things going on right now.
You have, there's so many ideas that have come up over the past hour. We just have a moment or two left. Do you feel like you need to sort of clone Benetech? I mean, how do you sort through all of this wealth of possibility that comes through your front door?
Well, you know, my first donor basically told me that if all I did was do a second project after the Reading Machine for the Blind project, he wouldn't be that enthusiastic. He said, it's your job to have Benetech do 10 or 20 new projects. You can't run any of them. And you should catalyze the creation of 1,000. So what I really love doing is sort of evangelizing for this social good. I think it's actually in the hearts of most people to want to do this. I want to make it seem that it's like within your reach to do it.
Well, here's someone who'd like that advice. This person writes, and I'm an executive with a tech company that would like to make the career change to nonprofit work in the next 5 years. Can Mr. Fruchterman offer advice and insight on what leadership skills are needed and what's transferable?
Well, you know, some people come out of high tech and think that the nonprofit world or the education world is full of people who aren't very sophisticated. And I say, look, use the same amount of skill you'd use in trying to assess a new market. Understand what people are doing and why. Don't tell them that they're lazy or not smart. Tell them, figure out why they're doing what they're doing, and then tinker with the incentives or the disincentives. That's what you do in business. If you want to make large-scale social change, get close to those customers, understand their lives, get in partnership with them, and then help change the incentives and disincentives, whether it's microcredit or a better software tool or a new way of solving an education problem.
You are a bit of an evangelist.
This is a lot more fun than working for the VCs. I loved my VCs, but I love this more.
Jim Fruchterman, founder and CEO of Benetech, which aims to take technology and put it to social good. Pleasure having you on our program. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Christina Russo, and Vinny Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Many thanks also to our outgoing interns, Keith Manconi, Ernesto Morales, Dana Varinsky, and Catalina Villegas. Thanks all very much for all of their help as well. I'm Dave Iverson. Have a good weekend, everyone. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.